Nothing. Patrick's away all day training. Why? He waited just a few seconds before he said it, as if it actually gave him some pleasure to surprise me. We're going to a wedding. Afterward, I was never entirely sure why Will changed his mind about Alicia and Rupert's nuptials. I suspected there was probably a large dose of natural contrariness in his decision. Nobody expected him to go, probably least of all Alicia and Rupert themselves. Perhaps it was about finally getting closure. But I think in the last couple of months she'd lost the power to wound him. We decided we could manage without Nathan's help. I called up to make sure the marquee was suitable for Will's wheelchair, and Alicia sounded so flustered when she realized we weren't actually declining the invitation that it dawned on me that her embossed correspondence really had been for appearance's sake. Well, there is a very small step up into the marquee, but I suppose the people who are putting it up did say they could provide a ramp. She trailed off. That'll be lovely then. Thank you, I said. We'll see you on the day. We went online and picked out a wedding present. Will spent £120 on a silver picture frame and a vase that he said was absolutely vile for another £60. I was shocked that he would spend that much money on someone he didn't even like, but I'd worked out within weeks of being employed by the trainers that they had different ideas about money than I did. I decided to wear my red dress, partly because I knew Will liked it, and I figured today he was going to need all the minor boosts he could get, but also because I didn't actually have any other dresses that I felt brave enough to wear at such a gathering. Will had no idea of the fear I felt at the thought of going to a society wedding, let alone as the help. Every time I thought of the braying voices, the assessing glances in our direction, I wanted to spend the day watching Patrick run in circles instead. Perhaps it was shallow of me to even care, but I couldn't help it. The thought of those guests looking down on both of us was already tying my stomach in knots. I didn't say anything to Will, but I was afraid for him. Going to the wedding of an ex seemed a masochistic act at the best of times, but to go to a public gathering, one that would be full of his old friends and work colleagues, to watch her marry his former friend seemed to me a surefire route to depression. I tried to suggest as much the day before we left, but he brushed it off.
If I'm not worried about it, Clark, I don't think you should be, he said.
I rang Trina and told her. Check his wheelchair for anthrax and ammunition, was all she said. It's the first time I've gotten him a proper distance from home, and it's going to be a bloody disaster. Maybe he just wants to remind himself that there are worse things than dying. Funny. Okay, have fun. Oh, and don't wear that red dress. It shows way too much cleavage. The morning of the wedding dawned bright and balmy, as I had secretly known it would. Girls like Alicia always got their way.
That's remarkably bitter of you, Clark, Will said when I told him.
Yes, well, I've learned from the best. Nathan had come early to get Will ready, so that we could leave the house by 9. It was a 2-hour drive, and I'd built in rest stops, planning our route carefully to ensure we had the best facilities available. I got ready in the bathroom, pulling stockings over my newly shaved legs, painting on makeup, and then rubbing it off again in case the posh guests thought I looked like a call girl. I dared not put a scarf around my neck, but I'd brought a wrap which I could use as a shawl if I felt overexposed.
Not bad, eh?
Nathan stepped back, and there was Will in a dark suit, a cornflower blue shirt and a tie. He was clean-shaven and carried a faint tan on his face. The shirt made his eyes look peculiarly vivid. They seemed, suddenly, to carry a glint of the sun.
Not bad, I said.
because weirdly I didn't want to say how handsome he actually looked.
She'll certainly be sorry she's marrying that braying bucket of lard anyway.
Will raised his eyes heavenward.
Nathan, do we have everything in the bag?
Yep, all set and ready to go.
He turned to Will.
No snogging the bridesmaids now.
As if he'd want to, I said. They'll all be wearing pie-crust collars and smell of horse.
Will's parents came out to see him off. I suspected they'd just had an argument, as Mrs. Traynor could not have stood farther away from her husband unless they'd actually been in separate counties. She kept her arms folded firmly, even as I reversed the car for Will to get in. She didn't once look at me.
"Don't get him too drunk, Louisa," she said, brushing imaginary lint from Will's shoulder.
"Why?" Will said. "I'm not driving." "You're quite right, Will," his father said. "I always needed a good stiff drink or two to get through a wedding."
"Even your own," Mrs. Traynor murmured, adding more audibly, "You look very smart, darling." She knelt down, adjusting the hem of Will's trousers.
"Really, very smart."
"So do you."
Mr. Traynor eyed me approvingly as I stepped out of the driver's seat.
"Very eye-catching. Give us a twirl, then, Louisa."
Will turned his chair away.
"She doesn't have time, Dad. Let's get on the road, Clark. I'm guessing it's bad form to wheel yourself in behind the bride."
I climbed back into the car with relief. With Will's chair secured in the back and his smart jacket hung neatly over the passenger's seat so that it wouldn't crease, we set off. I could have told you what Alicia's parents' house would be like even before I got there. In fact, my imagination got it so nearly spot on that Will asked me why I was laughing as I slowed the car. A large Georgian rectory, its tall windows partly obscured by showers of pale wisteria, its drive a caramel pea shingle. It was the perfect house for a colonel. I could already picture her growing up within it, her hair in two neat blonde plaits as she sat astride her first fat pony on the lawn. Two men in reflective tabards were directing traffic into a field between the house and the church beside it. I wound down the window. "Is there a car park beside the church?"
"Guests are this way, madam."
"Well, we have a wheelchair, and it'll sink into the grass here," I said. "We need to be right beside the church. I'll just go there."
The two men looked at each other and murmured something between themselves. Before they could say anything else, I drove up and parked in the secluded spot beside the church.
"And here it starts," I told myself, catching Will's eye in the mirror as I turned off the ignition.
"Chill out, Clark. It's all going to be fine," he said.
"I'm perfectly relaxed. Why would you think I wasn't?"
"You're ridiculously transparent. Plus, you've chewed off four of your fingernails while you've been driving."
"So, how are we playing today?" Will followed my line of vision.
"Honestly?"
"Yep. I need to know. And please don't say shock and awe. Are you planning something terrible?" Will's eyes met mine. Blue. Unfathomable. A small cloud of butterflies landed in my stomach.
"We're going to be incredibly well-behaved, Clark."
The butterfly's wings began to beat wildly, as if trapped against my ribcage. I began to speak, but he interrupted me.
"Look, we'll just do whatever it takes to make it fun," he said.
Fun? As if going to an ex's wedding could ever be less painful than root canal surgery. But it was Will's choice. Will's day. I took a breath, trying to pull myself together. "One exception," I said, adjusting the wrap around my shoulders for the 14th time.
"What?"
You're not to do the Christy Brown. If you do the Christy Brown, I will drive home and leave you stuck here with the pointy heads. As Will turned and began making his way toward the church, I thought I heard him murmur, "Spoil sport." We sat through the ceremony without incident. Alicia looked as ridiculously beautiful as I'd known she would, her skin polished a pale caramel, the bias cut off-white silk skimming her slim figure as if it wouldn't dare rest there without permission. I stared at her as she floated down the aisle, wondering how it would feel to be tall and long-legged and look like something most of us only saw on airbrushed posters. I wondered if she was wearing control pants. Of course not. She would be wearing pale wisps of something lacy, underwear for women who didn't need anything actually supported and which cost more than my weekly salary. While the vicar droned on and the little ballet-shod bridesmaids shuffled in their pews, I gazed around me at the other guests. There was barely a woman there who didn't look like she might appear in the pages of a glossy magazine. Their shoes, which matched their outfits to the exact hue, looked as if they'd never been worn before. The younger women stood elegantly in 4 or 5 inch heels with perfectly manicured toenails. The older women, in kitten heels, wore structured suits with padded shoulders and silk linings in contrasting colours, and hats that looked as if they defied gravity. The men were less interesting to look at, but nearly all had that air about them that I could sometimes detect in Will, of wealth and entitlement, a sense that life would settle itself agreeably around them. I wondered about the companies they ran, the worlds they inhabited. I wondered if they noticed people like me who nannied their children or served them in restaurants. Or pole-danced for their business colleagues, I thought, remembering my interviews at the job centre. The weddings I went to usually had to separate the brides' and grooms' families for fear of someone breaching the terms of their parole. And then it was over. Will was already making his way out toward the exit of the church. I watched the back of his head, upright and curiously dignified, and wanted to ask him if it had been a mistake to come. I wanted to ask him if he still had feelings for her. I wanted to tell him that he was too good for that silly caramel woman, no matter what appearances might suggest, and that... I didn't know what else I wanted to say. I just wanted to make it better. "You okay?" I said, as I caught up. The bottom line was, it should have been him. He blinked a couple of times. "Fine," he said. He let out a little breath, as if he'd been holding it. Then he looked up at me. "Come on, let's go and get a drink." The marquee was situated in a walled garden, the wrought-iron gateway into it intertwined with garlands of pale pink flowers. The bar, positioned at the far end, was already crowded, so I suggested that Will wait outside while I went and got him a drink. I weaved my way through tables clad in white linen cloths and laden with more cutlery and glassware than I'd ever seen. The chairs had gilt backs, like the ones you see at fashion shows, and white lanterns hung above each centerpiece of freesias and lilies. The air was thick with the scent of flowers, to the point that I found it almost stifling.
"Pims," the barman said when I got to the front.
I looked around, seeing that this was actually the only drink on offer.
"Oh, okay, 2, please."
He smiled at me.
"The other drinks come out later, apparently. But Miss Dewar wanted everyone to start with Pims."
The look he gave me was slightly conspiratorial. It told me with the faintest lift of an eyebrow what he thought of that. I stared at the pink lemonade drink. My dad said it was always the richest people who were the tightest, but I was amazed that they wouldn't even start the wedding reception with alcohol. "I guess that'll have to do then," I said, and took the glasses from him. When I found Will, there was a man talking to him. Young, bespectacled, he was half crouching, one arm resting on the arm of Will's chair. The sun was now high in the sky, and I had to squint to see them properly. I could suddenly see the point of all those wide-brimmed hats.
"So bloody good to see you out again, Will," he was saying. "The office isn't the same without you. I shouldn't say as much, but it's not the same, it just isn't."
He looked like a young accountant, the kind of man who's only really comfortable in a suit.
"It's nice of you to say so."
It was just so odd, like you fell off a cliff. One day you were there, directing everything. The next, we were just supposed to... He glanced up as he noticed me standing there.
"Oh,"
he said, and I felt his eyes settle on my chest.
"Hello. Louisa Clark, meet Freddie Derwent."
I put Will's glass in his holder and shook the younger man's hand. He adjusted his sight line.
"Oh," he said again. "And..."
"I'm a friend of Will's," I said, and then, not entirely sure why, let my hand rest lightly on Will's shoulder.
"Life not all bad, then," Freddie Derwent said, with a laugh that was a bit like a cough.
He flushed a little as he spoke.
"Anyway, must mingle. You know these things. Apparently we're meant to see them as a networking opportunity. But good to see you, Will. Really. And you, Miss Clark."
"He seemed nice," I said as we moved away. I lifted my hand from Will's shoulder and took a long sip of my Pimm's. It was actually tastier than it looked. I'd been slightly alarmed by the presence of cucumber.
"Yes, yes, he's a nice kid."
"Not too awkward, then?"
"No."
Will's eyes flickered up to meet mine.
"No, Clark, not too awkward at all."
As if freed by the sight of Freddie Derwent doing so, over the next hour several more people approached Will to say hello. Some stood a little way back from him, as if this absolved them of the handshake dilemma, while others hoisted the knees of their trousers and crouched down almost at his feet. I stood by Will and said little. I watched him stiffen slightly at the approach of two of them. One, a big, bluff man with a cigar, seemed not to know what to say when he was actually there in front of Will, and settled for,
"Bloody nice wedding, wasn't it? Thought the bride looked splendid."
I guessed he hadn't known Alicia's romantic history. Another, who seemed to be some business rival of Will's, hit a more diplomatic note, but there was something in his very direct gaze, his straightforward questions about Will's condition, that I could see made Will tense. They were like two dogs circling each other, deciding whether to bare their teeth.
"New CEO of my old company," Will said, as the man finally departed with a wave. "I think he was just making sure that I wouldn't be trying to stage a takeover."
Alicia, floating around the garden, an ethereal vision, air-kissing and exclaiming, didn't approach us. I watched Will drain two glasses of Pimm's and was secretly glad. Lunch was served at 4 p.m. I thought that was a pretty odd time to serve lunch, but as Will pointed out, it was a wedding. Time seemed to have stretched and become meaningless anyway, its passage blurred by endless drinks and meandering conversations. I don't know if it was the heat or the atmosphere, but by the time we arrived at our table, I felt almost drunk. When I found myself babbling incoherently to the elderly man on my left, I realized there was actually a possibility. "Is there any alcohol in that Pimm stuff?" I said to Will, after I'd managed to tip the contents of the salt cellar into my lap.
"About the same as a glass of wine, in each one."
I stared at him in horror. Both of him.
"You're kidding! It had fruit in it! I thought that meant it was alcohol-free. How am I going to drive you home?"
"Some caregiver you are," he said.
He raised an eyebrow.
"What's it worth for me not to tell my mother?"
I was stunned by Will's reaction to the whole day. I'd thought I was going to get taciturn Will, sarcastic Will, at the very least silent Will. But he'd been charming to everybody. Even the arrival of soup at lunch didn't faze him. He just asked politely whether anybody would like to swap his soup for their bread, and the two girls on the far side of the table, who professed themselves wheat intolerant, nearly threw their rolls at him. The more anxious I grew about how I was going to sober up, the more upbeat and carefree Will became. The elderly woman on his right turned out to be a former MP who'd campaigned on the rights of the disabled, and she was one of the few people I'd seen talk to Will without the slightest discomfort. At one point I watched her feed him a slice of roulade. When she briefly got up to leave the table, he muttered that she'd once climbed Kilimanjaro. "I love old birds like that," he said. "I could just picture her with a mule and a pack of sandwiches, tough as old boots." I was less fortunate with the man on my left. He took about 4 minutes, the briefest of quizzes about who I was, where I lived, who I knew there, to work out that there was nothing I had to say that might be of interest to him. He turned back to the woman on his left, leaving me to plough silently through what remained of my lunch. At one point, when I started to feel properly awkward, I felt Will's arm slide off the chair beside me, and his hand landed on my arm. I glanced up, and he winked at me. I took his hand and squeezed it, grateful that he could see it. And then he moved his chair back 6 inches and brought me into the conversation with Mary Rawlinson.
"So Will tells me you're in charge of him," she said.
She had piercing blue eyes and wrinkles that told of a life impervious to skincare routines. "I try," I said, glancing at him.
"And have you always worked in this field?"
"No, I used to work in a cafe." I'm not sure I would have told anybody else at this wedding that fact, but Mary Rawlinson nodded approvingly.
"I always thought that might be rather an interesting job, if you like people and are rather nosy, which I am." She beamed.
Will moved his arm back onto his chair.
"I'm trying to encourage Louisa to do something else, to widen her horizons a bit." "What did you have in mind?" she asked me.
"She doesn't know," Will said. "Louisa is one of the smartest people I know, but I can't make her see her own possibilities." Mary Rawlinson gave him a sharp look.
"Don't patronize her, dear. She's quite capable of answering for herself."
I blinked.
"I rather think that you, of all people, should know that," she added.
Will looked as if he were about to say something, and then closed his mouth. He stared at the table and shook his head a little, but he was smiling.
"Well, Louisa, I imagine your job at the moment takes up an awful lot of mental energy, and I don't suppose this young man is the easiest of clients."
"You can say that again."
"But Will is quite right about seeing possibilities. Here's my card. I'm on the board of a charitable organization that encourages retraining. Perhaps you would like to consider something different in the future."
"I'm very happy working with Will, thank you." I took the card that she proffered, regardless, a little stunned that this woman would have the slightest interest in what I did with my life. But even as I took it, I felt like an imposter. There was no way I would be able to give up work, even if I knew what I wanted to learn. I wasn't convinced I was the kind of person who would suit retraining. And besides, keeping Will alive was my priority. I was so lost in my thoughts that I briefly stopped listening to the two of them beside me.
"It's very good that you've got over the hump, so to speak. I know it can be crushing to have to readjust your life so dramatically around new expectations."
I stared at the remains of my poached salmon. I'd never heard anyone speak to Will like that. He frowned at the table and then turned back to her,
I'm not sure I am over the hump, he said quietly. She eyed him for a moment and glanced over at me. I wondered if my face betrayed me. Everything takes time, Will, she said, placing her hand briefly on his arm. And that's something that your generation find it a lot harder to adjust to. You've all grown up expecting things to go your way almost instantaneously. You all expect to live the lives you chose, especially a successful young man like yourself. But it takes time. Mrs. Rawlinson, Mary, I'm not expecting to recover, he said. I'm not talking about physically, she said. I'm talking about learning to embrace a new life. And then, just as I waited to hear what Will was going to say next, there was a loud tapping of a spoon on a glass, and the room hushed for the speeches. I barely heard what they said. It seemed to me to be one puffed-up, penguin-suited man after another, referring to people and places I didn't know, provoking polite laughter. I sat and chewed my way through the dark chocolate truffles that had arrived in silver baskets on the table, and drank 3 cups of coffee in quick succession, so that as well as feeling drunk, I felt jittery and wired. Will, on the other hand, was a picture of stillness. He sat and watched the guests applaud his ex-girlfriend, and listened to Rupert drone on about what a perfectly wonderful woman Alicia was. Nobody acknowledged Will. I don't know if that was because they wanted to spare his feelings, or because his presence there was actually a bit of an embarrassment. Occasionally Mary Rawlinson leaned in and muttered something into his ear, and he nodded slightly, as if in agreement. When the speeches finally ended, an army of staff appeared and began clearing the center of the room for dancing. Will leaned into me. Mary reminded me there's a very good hotel up the road. Ring them and see if we can stay there. What? Mary handed me a name and a telephone number scribbled on a napkin. It's okay, Clark, he said quietly, so that she couldn't hear. I'll pay. Go on, and then you can stop worrying about how much you've drunk. Grab my credit card from my bag. They'll probably want to take the number. I took it, reached for my mobile phone, and walked off into the farther reaches of the garden. They had 2 rooms available, they said, a single and a double on the ground floor. Yes, it was suitable for disabled access. Perfect, I said, and then had to swallow a small yelp when they told me the price. I gave them Will's credit card number, feeling slightly sick as I read the numbers. So, he said when I reappeared, I've done it, but... I told him how much the 2 rooms had come to. That's fine, he said. Now ring that bloke of yours to tell him you're staying out all night, then have another drink. In fact, have 6. It would please me no end to see you get hammered on Alicia's father's bill. And so I did. Something happened that evening. The lights dropped, so that our little table was less conspicuous. The overpowering fragrance of the flowers was tempered by the evening breezes, and the music and the wine and the dancing meant that, in the most unlikely of places, we all began to actually enjoy ourselves. Will was the most relaxed I'd seen him. Sandwiched between me and Mary, he talked and smiled at her, and there was something about the sight of him being briefly happy that repelled those people who might otherwise have looked at him askance or offered pitying glances. He made me lose my wrap and sit up straight. I took off his jacket and loosened his tie, and we both tried not to giggle at the sight of the dancing. I cannot tell you how much better I felt once I saw the way posh people danced. The men looked as if they'd been electrocuted. The women did little pointy fingers at the stars and looked horribly self-conscious even as they twirled.
Mary Rawlinson muttered, "Dear God," several times. She glanced over at me. Her language had gotten saltier with every drink.
"You don't want to go and stretch your stuff, Louisa?"
"God, no."
"Jolly sensible of you. I've seen better dancing at a bloody young farmer's club disco."
At 9, I got a text from Nathan.
"All okay?"
I responded, "Yes, lovely, believe it or not. Will having great time." And he was. I watched him laughing hard at something Mary had said, and something in me grew strange and tight. This had shown me it could work. He could be happy, if surrounded by the right people, if allowed to be Will instead of the man in the wheelchair, the list of symptoms, the object of pity. And then, at 10 p.m., the slow dances began. We watched Rupert guide Alicia around the dance floor, applauded politely by onlookers. Her hair had begun to droop, and she wrapped her arms around his neck as if she needed the support. Rupert's arms encircled her, his hands resting on the small of her back. Beautiful and wealthy as she was, I felt a little sorry for her. I thought she probably wouldn't realize what she'd lost until it was much too late. Halfway through the song, other couples joined them, so that they were partially obscured from view, and I got distracted by Mary talking about caregivers' allowances, until suddenly I looked up, and there she was, standing right in front of us, the supermodel in her white silk dress. My heart lodged in my throat. Alicia nodded a greeting to Mary and dipped a little from her waist so that Will could hear her over the music. Her face was a little tense, as if she'd had to prime herself to come over. "Thank you for coming, Will. Really." She glanced sideways at me but said nothing.
"Pleasure," Will said smoothly. "You look lovely, Alicia. It was a great day."
A flicker of surprise passed across her face, and then a faint wistfulness.
"Really? You think so?" "I do think... I mean, there's so much I want to say."
"There's no need," Will said. "You remember Louisa?"
"I do."
There was a brief silence. I could see Rupert hovering in the background, eyeing us all warily. She glanced back at him and then held out a hand in a half wave.
"Well, thank you anyway, Will. You are a superstar for coming. And thank you for the...
mirror."
"Of course. I absolutely loved the mirror." She stood up and walked back to her husband, who turned away, already clasping her arm.
We watched them cross the dance floor.
"You didn't buy her a mirror."
"I know."
They were still talking, Rupert's gaze flickering back to us. It was as if he couldn't believe Will had simply been nice.
Mind you, neither could I.
"Did it bother you?"
I said to him.
He looked away from them.
"No,"
he said, and he smiled at me. His smile had gone a bit lopsided with drink, and his eyes were sad and contemplative at the same time.
And then, as the dance floor briefly emptied for the next dance, I found myself saying, "What do you say, Will? Going to give me a whirl?"
"What?"
"Come on. Let's give these fuckers something to talk about."
"Oh, good," Mary said, raising a glass. "Fucking marvellous."
"Come on, while the music is slow, because I don't think you can pogo in that thing." I didn't give him any choice. I sat down carefully on Will's lap, draped my arms around his neck to hold myself in place. He looked into my eyes for a minute, as if working out whether he could refuse me. Then,
Astonishingly, Will wheeled us out onto the dance floor and began moving in small circles under the sparkling lights of the mirror balls. I felt simultaneously acutely self-conscious and mildly hysterical. I was sitting at an angle that meant my dress had risen halfway up my thighs.
"Leave it," Will murmured into my ear.
"This is..."
"Come on, Clark. Don't let me down now."
I closed my eyes and wrapped my arms around his neck, letting my cheek rest against his, breathing in the citrus smell of his aftershave. I could feel him humming along with the music.
"Are they all appalled yet?" he said.
I opened one eye and glanced out into the dim light. A couple of people were smiling encouragingly, but most seemed not to know what to make of it. Mary saluted me with her drink. And then I saw Alicia staring at us, her face briefly falling. When she saw me looking, she turned away and muttered something to Rupert. He shook his head, as if we were doing something disgraceful. I felt a mischievous smile creeping across my face.
"Oh, yes," I said.
"Huh. Move in closer. You smell fantastic."
"So do you.
Although if you keep turning in left-hand circles, I may throw up." Will changed direction. My arms looped around his neck. I pulled back a little to look at him, no longer self-conscious. He glanced down at my chest. To be fair, with me positioned where I was, there wasn't anywhere else he could look. He lifted his gaze from my cleavage and raised an eyebrow.
"You know, you would never have let those breasts get so close to me if I weren't in a wheelchair," he murmured.
I looked back at him steadily. "You would never have looked at my breasts if you hadn't been in a wheelchair."
"What? Of course I would."
"Nope. You would have been far too busy looking at the tall blonde girls with the endless legs and the big hair, the ones who can smell an expense account at 40 paces. And anyway, I wouldn't have been here. I would have been serving the drinks over there, one of the invisibles." He blinked.
"Well, I'm right, aren't I?"
Will glanced over at the bar, then back at me.
"Yes. But in my defense, Clark, I was an ass."
I burst out laughing so hard that even more people looked over in our direction. I tried to straighten my face.
"Sorry," I mumbled. "I think I'm getting hysterical."
"Do you know something?" I could have looked at his face all night, the way his eyes wrinkled at the corners. That place where his neck met his shoulder.
"What?" "Sometimes, Clark, you're pretty much the only thing that makes me want to get up in the morning."
"Then let's go somewhere." The words were out almost before I knew what I wanted to say.
"What?"
"Let's go somewhere. Let's have a week where we just have fun. You and me. None of these..."
He waited. "Arses?"
"Arses! Say yes, Will. Go on." His eyes didn't leave mine. I don't know what I was telling him. I don't know where it all came from. I just knew if I didn't get him to say yes tonight, with the stars and the freesias and the laughter and Mary, then I had no chance at all. "Please." The seconds before he answered me seemed to take forever.
"Okay," he said.
Chapter 19. Nathan. They thought we couldn't tell. They finally got back from the wedding around lunchtime the following day, and Mrs. Traynor was so mad she could barely even speak. "You could have rung," she said. She had stayed in just to make sure they arrived back okay. I had listened to her pacing up and down the tiled corridor next door since I got there at 8 a.m. I must have called or texted you both 18 times. It was only when I managed to call the Dewar's house, and somebody told me the man in the wheelchair had gone to a hotel, that I could be sure you hadn't both had some terrible accident on the motorway. The man in the wheelchair. Nice, Will observed. But you could see he wasn't bothered. He was all loose and relaxed, carried his hangover with humour, even though I had the feeling he was in some pain. It was only when his mum started to have a go at Louisa that he stopped smiling. He jumped in and just said that if she had anything to say, she should say it to him, as it had been his decision to stay overnight, and Louisa had simply gone along with it. And as far as I can see, Mother, as a 35-year-old man, I'm not strictly answerable to anybody when it comes to choosing to spend a night at a hotel, even to my parents. She had stared at them both, muttered something about common courtesy, and then left the room. Louisa looked a bit shaken, but he had gone over and murmured something to her, and that was the point at which I saw it. She went kind of pink and laughed. The kind of laugh you do when you know you shouldn't be laughing. A kind of laugh that spoke of a conspiracy. And then Will turned to her and told her to take it easy for the rest of the day. Go home, get changed, maybe catch 40 winks. I can't be walking around the castle with someone who has so clearly just done the walk of shame, he said. Walk of shame? I couldn't keep the surprise from my voice. Not that walk of shame, Louisa said, flicking me with her scarf, and grabbed her coat to leave. Take the car, he called out. It'll be easier for you to get back. I watched Will's eyes follow her all the way to the back door. I would have offered you 7 to 4 just on the basis of that look alone. He deflated a little after she left. It was as if he'd been holding on until both his mum and Louisa had left the annex. I'd been watching him carefully now, and once his smile left his face, I realized I didn't like the look of him. His skin held a faint blotchiness. He had winced twice when he thought no one was looking, and I could see even from here that he had goosebumps. A little alarm bell had started to sound, distant but shrill, inside my head. "You feeling okay, Will?" I'm fine. Don't fuss. You want to tell me where it hurts? He looked a bit resigned then, as if he knew I saw straight through him. We had worked together a long time. Okay. Bit of a headache, and, I need my tubes changed. Probably quite sharpish. I had transferred him from his chair onto his bed, and now I began getting the equipment together. What time did Lou do them this morning? She didn't, he winced, and he looked a little guilty. Or last night.
What?
I took his pulse and grabbed the blood pressure equipment. Sure enough, it was sky high. When I put my hand on his forehead, it came away with a faint sheen of sweat. I went for the medicine cabinet and crushed some vasodilator drugs. I gave them to him in water, making sure he drank every last bit. Then I propped him up, placing his legs over the side of the bed, and I changed his tube swiftly, watching him all the while. AD? Yeah. Not your most sensible move, Will. Autonomic dysreflexia was pretty much our worst nightmare. It was Will's body's massive overreaction against pain, discomfort, or, say, an unemptied catheter. His damaged nervous system's vain and misguided attempt to stay in control. It could come out of nowhere and send his body into meltdown. He looked pale, his breathing labored. How's your skin? Bit prickly. Sight? Fine. Ah, man, do you think we need help? Give me 10 minutes, Nathan. I'm sure you've done everything we need. Give me 10 minutes. He closed his eyes. I checked his blood pressure again, wondering how long I should leave it before calling an ambulance. AD scared the hell out of me, because you never knew which way it was going to go. He had had it once before, when I had first started working with him, and he had ended up in hospital for 2 days. Really, Nathan, I'll tell you if I think we're in trouble. He sighed, and I helped him backwards so that he was leaning against his headboard. He told me Louisa had been so drunk he hadn't wanted to risk letting her loosen his equipment. God knows where she might have stuck the ruddy tubes. He half laughed as he said it.
It had taken Louisa almost half an hour just to get him out of his chair and into bed, he said.
They had both ended up on the floor twice. Luckily, we were both so drunk by then, I don't think either of us felt a thing. She had had the presence of mind to call down to reception, and they had asked a porter to help lift him. Nice chap. I have a vague memory of insisting Louisa give him a £50 tip. I knew she was properly drunk because she agreed to it. Will had been afraid, when she finally left his room, that she wouldn't actually make it to hers. He'd had visions of her curled up in a little red ball on the stairs. My own view of Louisa Clark was a little less generous just at that moment. Well, mate, I think maybe next time you should worry a little bit more about yourself, yeah? I'm all right, Nathan. I'm fine. Feeling better already. I felt his eyes on me as I checked his pulse. Really, it wasn't her fault. His blood pressure was down. His color was returning to normal in front of me. I let out a breath I hadn't realized I'd been holding. We chatted a bit, passing the time while everything settled down, discussing the previous day's events. He didn't seem a bit bothered about his ex. He didn't say much, but for all he was obviously exhausted, he looked okay. I let go of his wrist. Nice tattoo, by the way. He gave me a wry look. Make sure you don't graduate to an N-by, yeah? Despite the sweats and the pain and the infection, he looked for once like there was something else on his mind other than the thing that consumed him. I couldn't help thinking that if Mrs. Traynor had known this, she might not have kicked off as hard as she did. We didn't tell her anything of the lunchtime events. Will made me promise not to. But when Lou came back later that afternoon, she was pretty quiet. She looked pale, with her hair washed and pulled back like she was trying to look sensible. But it became clear after a while that it wasn't just the hangover troubling her. Will kept on and on at her about why she was being so quiet, and then she said, "Yes, well, I've discovered it's not the most sensible thing to stay out all night when you've just moved in with your boyfriend." She was smiling as she said it, but it was a forced smile, and Will and I both knew that there must have been some serious words. I couldn't really blame the guy. I wouldn't have wanted my missus staying out all night with some bloke, even if he was a quad. And he hadn't seen the way Will looked at her. We didn't do much that afternoon. Louisa emptied Will's backpack, revealing every free hotel shampoo, conditioner, miniature sewing kit and shower cap she could lay her hands on. "Don't laugh," she said. "At those prices, Will paid for a bloody shampoo factory." We watched some Japanese animated film, which Will said was perfect hangover viewing. And I stuck around, partly because I wanted to keep an eye on his blood pressure, and partly, to be honest, because I was being a bit mischievous. I wanted to see his reaction when I announced I was going to keep them both company. "Really?" he said. "You like Miyazaki?" He caught himself immediately, saying that of course I would love it, it was a great film, blah, blah, blah. But there it was. I was glad for him on one level. He had thought about one thing for too long, that man. So we watched the film, pulled down the blinds, took the phone off the hook, and watched this weird cartoon about a girl who ends up in a parallel universe with all these weird creatures, half of whom you couldn't tell if they were good or bad. Lou sat right up close to Will, handing him his drink, or, at one point, wiping his eye when he got something in it. It was quite sweet, really, although a little bit of me wondered what on earth this was going to lead to. And then, as Louisa pulled up the blinds and made us all some tea, they looked at each other like two people wondering whether to let you in on a secret. And they told me about going away. 10 days. Not sure where yet, but it would probably be long haul, and it would be good. Would I come and help? Does a bear shit in the woods? I had to take my hat off to the girl. If you had told me 4 months ago that we'd get Will off on a long-haul holiday, hell, that we would get him out of this house, I would have told you you were a few sandwiches short of a picnic. Mind you, I'd have a quiet word with her about Will's medical care before we went. We couldn't afford a near-miss like that again if we were stuck in the middle of nowhere. They even told Mrs. T as she popped by, just as Louisa was leaving. Will said it like it was no more remarkable than him going for a walk around the castle. I have to tell you, I was really pleased. That ruddy online poker site had eaten all my money, and I wasn't even planning on a holiday this year. I even forgave Louisa for being stupid enough to listen to Will when he said he hadn't wanted her to do his tubes. And believe me, I had been pretty pissed about that. So it was all looking great, and I was whistling when I shouldered my way into my coat, already looking forward to white sands and blue seas. I was even trying to work out if I could tie in a short visit home to Auckland. And then I saw them. Mrs. Traynor standing outside the back door as Lou waited to set off down the road. I don't know what sort of a chat they'd had already, but they both looked grim. I only caught the last line, but, to be honest, that was enough for me. I hope you know what you're doing, Louisa.
Chapter 20.
You what?
We were on the hills just outside town when I told him. Patrick was halfway through a 16-mile run and wanted me to time him while following behind on the bicycle. As I was marginally less proficient on a bicycle than I was at particle physics, this involved a lot of swearing and swerving on my part and a lot of exasperated shouting on his. As we reached the top of Sheepcoat Hill, me puffing, my legs like lead, I decided to just throw it out there. I figured we still had 10 miles home for him to recover his good mood. I'm not coming to the Extreme Viking. He didn't stop, but he came close. He turned to face me, his legs still moving under him, and he looked so shocked that I nearly swerved into a tree.
What? Why?
I'm working. He turned back to the road and picked up speed. We'd reached the brow of the hill, and I had to close my fingers around the brakes a little to stop myself overtaking him.
So when did you decide this?
Fine beads of sweat had broken out on his forehead, and tendons stood out on his calves. I couldn't look at them too long or I would start wobbling.
On the weekend. I just wanted to be sure. But we've booked your flights and everything.
It's only EasyJet. I'll reimburse you the £39 if you're that bothered.
It's not the cost. I thought you were going to support me. You said you were coming to support me.
He could look quite sulky, Patrick. When we were first together, I used to tease him about it. I called him Mr. Grumpy Trousers. It made me laugh, and him so cross that he usually stopped sulking just to shut me up.
Oh, come on, I'm hardly not supporting you now, am I?
I hate cycling, Patrick. You know I do. But I'm supporting you. We went on another mile before he spoke again. It might have been me, but the pounding of Patrick's feet on the road seemed to have taken on a grim, resolute tone. We were high above the little town now, me puffing on the uphill stretches, trying and failing to stop my heart racing every time a car came past. I was on Mum's old bike. Patrick wouldn't let me anywhere near his racing demon, and it had no gears, so I was frequently left trailing him. He glanced behind and slowed his pace a fraction so that I could draw level.
"So why can't they get an agency person in?" he said.
"An agency person?"
"To come to the trainer's house. I mean, if you're there for 6 months, you must be entitled to a holiday."
"It's not that simple."
"I don't see why not. You started work there knowing nothing, after all."
I held my breath. This was quite hard, given that I was completely breathless from cycling.
"Because he needs to go on a trip."
"What?"
"He needs to go on a trip, so they need me and Nathan there to help him."
"Nathan? Who's Nathan?"
"His medical caregiver. The guy you met when Will came to Mum's. And before you ask," I added, "no, I am not having an affair with Nathan."
He slowed and glanced down at the tarmac,
until he was practically jogging on the spot.
What is this, Lou? Because it seems to me that there's a line being blurred here between what is work and what is...
He shrugged. Normal.
It's not a normal job, you know that.
But Will Traynor seems to take priority over everything these days.
Oh, and this doesn't?
I took my hand off the handlebars and gestured towards his shifting feet.
That's different. He calls, you come running.
And you go running, I come running. I tried to smile.
Very funny.
He turned away.
It's 6 months, Pat. 6 months. You were the one who thought I should take this job, after all. You can't have a go at me for taking it seriously.
I don't think it's about the job. I think there's something you're not telling me.
I hesitated just a moment too long.
That's not true. But you won't come to the Viking.
I've told you, I...
He shook his head slightly, as if he couldn't hear me properly. Then he began to run down the road away from me. I could see from the set of his back how angry he was.
Oh, come on, Patrick. Can't we just stop for a minute and discuss this?
His tone was mulish.
No, it will throw up my time.
Then let's stop the clock, just for 5 minutes.
No, I have to do it in real conditions.
He began to run faster, as if he had gained a new momentum.
Patrick,
I said, struggling suddenly to keep up with him. My feet slipped on the pedals and I cursed, kicking a pedal back to try to set off again.
Patrick! Patrick!
I stared at the back of his head, and the words were out of my mouth almost before I knew what I was saying.
Okay. Will wants to die. He wants to commit suicide. And this trip is my last attempt to change his mind.
Patrick's stride shortened, and then slowed. He stopped on the road ahead, his back straight, still facing away from me. He turned slowly. He had finally stopped jogging.
Say that again?
He wants to go to Dignitas in August. I'm trying to change his mind. This is the last chance I have. He was staring at me like he didn't know quite whether to believe me. I know it sounds mad, but I have to change his mind, so I can't come to the Viking.
Why didn't you tell me this before?
I had to promise his family I wouldn't tell anyone. It would be awful for them if it got out. Awful. Look, even he doesn't know I know. It's all been tricky. I'm sorry. I reached out my hand to him. I would have told you if I could. He didn't answer. He looked crushed, as if I'd done something terrible. There was a faint frown on his face, and he swallowed twice, hard.
Pat? No, I just need to run now, Lou, by myself.
He ran a hand across his hair.
Okay?
I swallowed.
Okay.
He looked for a moment as if he'd forgotten why we were even out there. Then he struck off again, and I watched him disappear down the road in front of me, his head facing resolutely forward, his legs eating up the road beneath him. I had put the request out on the day after we returned from the wedding.
Can anyone tell me a good place to go where quadriplegics can have adventures? I am looking for things that an able-bodied person might be able to do, things that might make my depressed friend forget for a while that his life is a bit limited.
I don't really know what I'm hoping for, but all suggestions gratefully received. This is quite urgent.